Hello, I'm Angela, one of today's readers. Welcome to the primary edition of your local talking newspaper, covering St Albans, Harpenden and all the villages within the district. The piece of music that you've just heard is called Good Times. We hope you enjoyed listening to it. We'll be playing all of it later on. As always, our thanks go to Gough Be Music, which has allowed us to use this piece of music. Today's edition of your talking newspaper is for week ending the 2nd of June 2018, and the news items come from the Hearts Advertiser and the Review. And now here is my first news item. Headline is Caring for the Whole Community is Theme of New Mayor's Tenure. St Albans District Councillor Mohamed Iqbal Zia was replaced by Councillor Rosemary Farmer at a council meeting last week, and Councillor Brian Gibbard was appointed the new Deputy Mayor at the same time. Councillor Farmer said it's a huge honour to be the 475th Mayor of St Albans. I'm looking forward to serving the community and representing the council at local and civic events throughout the year. My theme for the year is Serving and Caring for All in Our Community. There are people in our society who are often overlooked, such as those suffering from mental health issues or who are older people living alone. They're all part of our community and we need to help them feel included and supported. She has picked mental health charity Mind in Mid Hearts to support throughout the coming year. As Mayor, I'll be encouraging people to reach out to anyone who appears to be isolated and help ensure that they get any care and support they need. Chief Executive Officer for Mind in Mid Hearts, Sean Tomlinson, said, "We're delighted that the Mayor has chosen to support Mind in Mid Hearts during her year in office. We're a small charity offering people access to a range of mental health services focused around prevention, recovery and social support." Born in the Chilterns, Councillor Farmer is a former banker and was one of the first ever women bank executives in the City of London. The English Language and Literature graduate has lived in Harpenden since 1999, served on the District Council since 2012, and has been an active member of the community in that time. For example, she's a trustee of Drugling, a member of the Harpenden Trust Care Fund Committee, and a trustee of Harpenden Connect, otherwise known as the Harpenden Hopper. She's also a governor of the Hertfordshire Partnership University NHS Foundation Trust. The Mayor's consort for the year will be Councillor Farmer's sister, Susan Farmer. Former engineer Councillor Gibbard was born in St Albans City Hospital and has raised a family in the area.
Hello, this is Bill. My first item is about a 12-year-old recovering from a kidney transplant who has been treated to a special bowling party with a YouTube video star. Harpenden's Ross Sutherland met blogger Ollie White at a bowling party organised by Razor Sunshine, a charity dedicated to brightening the lives of children with serious or life-limiting illnesses. When Ross was just a week old, his mum Elizabeth had to resuscitate him at home. 12 months later, he was diagnosed with renal failure, which he has been battling ever since. Throughout his life, Ross has been forced to have regular hospital visits, scans, blood tests, and finally, a kidney transplant at Great Ormond Street Hospital in February this year. Although he was in hospital for 8 weeks after the surgery, the transplant should offer relief from Ross's symptoms, and he will not need to go under the knife again for at least 30 years. He now has 3 kidneys, a new one and his original 2, which have both failed. The Roundwood Park student loves watching blogs and even has his own YouTube channel, Underburn Brawler, and was treated to the outing as a respite and distraction from his illness. Ollie White, who is an ambassador for the charity, said, "It was great to be part of something so positive and help Razor Sunshine put a big smile on all the children's faces like Ross. That's why I'm delighted to be an ambassador for the charity and help them to continue to grant magical wishes brave children." Ross quizzed Ollie about vlogging, gaming and pranking. Ollie's video collection includes trying food my brother has never liked, burglary prank on my parents. Mum Elizabeth Sutherland said, "Thank you so much, Razor Sunshine, for inviting Ross to meet with Ollie. He had a lovely time and Ross really enjoyed himself. The outing really gave him his spark back, which he'd been missing for a while, and he can't stop smiling." She said he was lucky to have had outstanding treatment in hospitals through his life and thankful for his amazing close-knit group of friends who are hugely supportive and kind. The party was held at All Star Bowling in Holborn earlier this month.
Hello, I'm Deborah, and my first article is entitled "The Wait is Almost Over as New Museum Prepares for Opening." With just over a week to go before its official opening, staff are working flat out to get St Albans' new museum and gallery ready for its much-anticipated launch. Restoring the town hall has taken 2 years and cost £7.75 million. Opening on June the 8th, it will be free to all visitors and showcases more than 2,000 years of heritage from St Albans and around the world. The initial temporary exhibition is First Impressions, which celebrates the city's key role in the country's printing industry and will include both the first colour book printed in Britain and the first edition of the Hearts Advertiser. Golden chandeliers were recently raised in the assembly room, which will initially feature a specially commissioned installation from artist Susie McMurray, known for her dramatic pieces in historic buildings. Taking inspiration from the room's former function, Susie has used a combination of silk, velvet and raw wire to comment on the public and private roles of women who may have graced the dance floor. While other displays include her acclaimed works Medusa and Strange Fruit. At the heart of the museum, in the Grand Staircase Gallery, is a permanent exhibition telling the story of St Albans' development from 110,000 BC to the present day, taking in the Romans, Boudicca's Revolt, the War of the Roses, Sir Francis Bacon and Samuel Ryder on the way. Limited edition honours boards etched with the names of donors have now been hung in the walls of a benefactor's Walk of Fame, which connects the new Western Gallery and the Georgian prison cells. Councillor Annie Brewster, portfolio holder for Sports, Heritage and Leisure, has been at the heart of the project since its inception and was instrumental in not only achieving the lion's share of fundraising, but ensuring the oak boards and chandeliers became a reality. She told the Hearts ad, "I inherited this project 4 years ago as I finished being mayor, and feel truly honoured to have played my part in the history of this landmark building. Seeing new life breathed back into our iconic Grade 2-star listed town hall is almost a reality and is beyond exciting. I would like to thank everyone who has risen to this challenge, our magnificent team, our partners, our generous benefactors, but most of all, the community in its relentless support for this new chapter for the city."
Hello, I'm Bill Lawley-York. And my first article is that volunteering is for all at Rennie Grove, so why not join their award-winning team of helpers? Rennie Grove Hospice Care is celebrating Volunteers Week, June the 1st to the 7th, by spreading the message that volunteering is for all. The charity relies on its 1,500-strong army of Queen's Award-winning volunteers to carry out essential support roles and simply could not care for so many patients without them. From extreme weather drivers and email listers to shop assistants and gardeners, Rennie Grove has a plethora of roles on offer, whether you want to utilise existing skills or learn new ones. And most importantly, Rennie Grove offers bite-sized volunteering opportunities to suit the time you have available. Susan Lewis, Volunteering Development Advisor at Rennie Grove, explained, "The face of volunteering is changing, with more people offering one-off chunks of time that they can fit around other commitments, such as paid employment, study or childcare. Some employers also give their staff time off during the working week to volunteer for local charities like ours. At Rennie Grove, we welcome this type of micro-volunteering because it is perfect for those who want to volunteer but who are time poor. Some examples of what people can do to support us include taking part in a street collection, holding an event, sponsoring a fundraising online, or buying an item from our eBay shop. We're also inviting people to give a shop a shift, which means a one-off day or half-day volunteering shift in one of our 27 charity shops. Two of our recent one-off volunteers found that they enjoyed the experience so much, they signed up to do it more often," added Susan. As part of this event and Festivals Management University course, Ross Brace is giving 100 hours voluntary service to Rennie Grove's community fundraising team. I'm really surprised at the different types of events and activities that I've been involved in already, said Ross. So far, I've done a street collection and have helped out at a celebrity sports dinner, quiz night, and at a village fair. None of these things that I would do in my everyday life, and I've really enjoyed myself. I'm also helping the team to organise and promote future events and would recommend volunteering with Rennie Grove, he added.
And now, under the heading Thameslink, we have County Council Leader calls for reassurances from rail companies and government. Councillor David Williams contacted the two government bodies and the rail operator after County Hall's censuring motion. MPs Anne Main and Bim Afolami have also criticised Govia Thameslink Railway, GTR, for the disruption, which has seen fuming commuters demand a return to the old timetable until the crisis is resolved. Passengers have highlighted a litany of issues, including a lack of communication, misinformed drivers, and trains stopping randomly at stations without warning. Councillor Williams said, I would like to reassure residents that I have written to Network Rail, Govia Thameslink Railway, and the Minister for the Department of Transport to explain that we do not believe the introduction of this programme has been to the benefit of Hertfordshire rail travellers, and the disruption on what was supposed to be a soft introduction, and mindful we have had ad hoc cancellations going back years, is yet more frustration for regular travellers. I'm particularly concerned there may be further delays to the essential remedial measures and have been seeking reassurances that all the necessary works will be introduced as soon as reasonably possible. An effective transport network is key to the challenges our growing country faces, and I look forward to hearing back from the train companies and the DfT with information on how they intend to address these issues. We will continue to monitor the situation. A GTR spokesperson said, we apologise to passengers for the continued disruption linked to the introduction of the new timetable. We are working on a recovery plan with rail industry partners. Meanwhile, as late notice changes continue to be made, we ask passengers to check train times on the day of travel. We expect disruption to ease over the coming months. A Network Rail spokesperson said, late timetables have certainly not helped the recent events, but there are many other factors across the industry involved, and we are looking at understanding the root cause so that future changes can be implemented more smoothly. The DfT was contacted for comment, but did not respond before the Hearts Advertiser went to press.
A local society has been overwhelmed with offers to save their unique historical archives following a Hearts ad appeal. The London Coney Local History Society revealed they were searching for a site to house six filing cabinets of documents in last week's paper. About 3,000 photographs and paper records that exist nowhere else are currently residing in a society member's home. However, that member is moving away, and if no other storage space could be found, the society feared it would be forced to destroy some or all of the files. The photographs have been digitalised, but as committee member Ken Barker said, obviously the originals are the ones with the historical value. However, since the Hearts ad article, four different organisations have come forward to save the records. Oliver and Acres Limited Estate Agents, London Coney Primary School, London Coney Parish Council, St Albans Museum and Gallery. Ken said, it's very good news, it's all very positive. We are very pleased with how the Hearts ad has been able to help us with this. What we are doing is visiting the three London Coney ones because we would want to keep the archives locally over the next few days to see the people, to see the security and the access. At the moment it all seems very positive. It's all due to Hearts ad. All the options will be considered before the Society makes a decision. The National Archives advise historical records are kept in controlled conditions, cold room with low humidity, away from food, which might attract insects, potentially leaking water. Ken said the offers, as well as positive social media response, shows how we value the London Coney Archives in the community. He is the editor of a history magazine called The Record, which uses the archives. He has been a resident of London Coney for about 20 years and has been helping at the History Society for the best part of a decade. The London Coney Local History Society was founded in 1997 and has about 120 members.
Rail freight firm warns against bid to build homes on former airfield site. Rail freight developers have strongly advised against building houses on the former Radlett airfield. In a letter to St Albans District Council, SADC, Helio Slough has argued that including the Park Street site in the draft local plan would cause the whole document to be inherently unsound. Instead, the developers would like to build a strategic rail freight interchange, SRFI, on the 100 hectares of Greenbelt. The SRFI plans have been highly contested. They were taken to High Court by SADC, continually scrutinised by St Albans MP Anne Main, and the catalyst behind campaign group Strife, Stop the Rail Freight Exchange. However, SADC's new local plan provided a glimmer of hope for protesters when landowners Herts County Council submitted the site for a possible 2,000 home development. Despite this, Helio Slough are forging on with their SRFI plans, recently gaining approval for the design, layout, access and infrastructure specifications. In the letter, Helio Slough director Gareth Osborne said, "Whilst I recognise that the provision of housing is important, I would point out that this type of development can be carried out across a range of locations and does not have the same site-specific requirements as an SRFI." Mr Osborne concluded by respectfully asking that the site is not pursued as a housing development. Planning portfolio holder for SADC, Councillor Mary Maynard, said, "SADC consulted with residents, and residents have very clearly said that they want the least harm done to Greenbelt because Greenbelt is close to their hearts. At the same time, residents recognise the need for more housing, particularly small family houses, starter homes for young people and affordable homes. We are carrying out a process and we will be doing that on planning criteria with a view to delivering the government's required housing numbers, and any sites brought forward will be expected to bring benefits to the community it wants to serve." St Albans MP Anne Main backs housing on the site. "I have always said this is a wholly inappropriate site for a rail freight interchange. The need for housing in the district is obvious, and we need to make those tough decisions. I am extremely pleased that this site will be considered for housing."
The St Albans Tales, a storytelling hike for refugees. Volunteers are trekking 55 miles into London to stand in solidarity with refugees. A large group of walkers are setting off from Fleetville Community Centre in July as part of the Refugee Tales project, an outreach programme organised by the Gatwick Detainees Welfare Group and inspired by Chaucer's The Canterbury Tales. The Detainees Group is a charity which provides support to people incarcerated indefinitely at Gatwick Airport. Over 5 days, the hikers are walking from St Albans to Westminster via Hartford, Waltham Abbey, Chingford and Stoke Newington. At each stop, there will be an evening event where professional writers, musicians and poets will share the true stories of immigrants detained at airports indefinitely. Refugee Tales has worked with the University of Kent to secure top writers and stay true to Chaucer's book, which is a collection of 24 stories written in Middle English. Co-founder of the walk, Mary Barrett, has been visiting detainees at Gatwick once a week for 20 years. Mary said, "We're not saying people shouldn't be detained or removed from this country if they are illegally here. We are just saying holding people without a time limit is very damaging for their minds and is very inefficient." She stressed that Britain is the only country in the European Union where people are legally detained indefinitely. "Many people who would consider themselves informed don't know about it because it's a well-kept secret in this country, but we are trying to inform people and raise awareness." She added, "It's changed a lot in 20 years. It's a lot tougher now, and that's why we are trying to change the rules. It can't go on for another 20 years. This is the fourth year running the fundraiser has taken place. Accommodation is provided for each night of the trip, and walkers can sign up for one night, the weekend, or the whole journey. The walk starts on July the 7th. All the evening events are open to the public. Entry is free.
Top rosettes for students in professional sheep handling at the Herts County Show. Oakland's College homebred Suffolk Shearling battled against hundreds of other sheep of various breeds to secure the Interbreed Sheep Champion rosette on the final day of the show. This breed has a signature dense coat against black legs and head. The college also secured reserve in an interbreed competition with their Longwood Teeswater. Oakland's farm manager, Del Knowles, said, "We've been working hard to build a reputation for the college at the Herts County Show, key event both for the local community in our county and the wider regional agriculture community in East Anglia. To come away with a top award twice over is a great achievement and reflects the hard work put in by our students." Pupils studying agriculture enter livestock into the show's sheep and cattle competitions each year. It can be the first time the students are scrutinised by judges in a public arena. Other entries are submitted by farming professionals and other specialist colleges. The college's Director of Student Experience, Sean Scully, said, "To see our students handling in front of the general public with such professionalism and expertise is wonderful. Their hard work and achievements mean all the more with recognition and support from their peers in the agriculture community. And we thank Herts County Show for the opportunity to showcase this unique part of college life at Oaklands." Thousands of people descended on Redbourne Showground for the county show at the weekend, which also offered a variety of circus fun, show jumping, cars and other attractions. Spectators enjoyed cattle, sheep, equestrian and show jumping displays in the various arenas on the site.
I have a heading here saying, "Heated debate in council over accuracy and truth in Greenbelt Homes Plan." Heckles were raised because St Albans District Council, SADC, is currently considering developing more than 2,000 hectares of land by Redbourne, part of a draft local plan. Chair of Redbourne Parish Council, David Mitchell, was initially invited to ask questions about the local plan at the Planning Policy Committee, but the exchange soon became tense. After he had asked six questions and had one clarified, Councillor Mitchell was asked to make way for the next speaker. Instead, Councillor Mitchell continued, "So you're disagreeing with the figures that are in your actual agenda?" There's a lot of confusion, actually. There's quite a lot of errors in there in the documents, which I can send you an email if you'd like me to show you where they are. Planning portfolio holder at SADC, Councillor Mary Maynard, was speaking at the same time. "Thank you, Councillor Mitchell. We have a number of other questions too, so could we please end this, please? And end this questioning. We have other questions here tonight. If you'd like to continue with any other questions, please contact us. But other questionnaires tonight are here. We have a very tight agenda. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Councillor Mitchell." "Councillor Mitchell, thank you," the Redbourne campaigner retorted. "I accept that, but we need the truth, don't we? We need accuracy and the truth. SADC is looking to build 15,000 homes in the district before 2036 based on housing affordability ratio. As 81% of the district is green belt and the rest is densely populated, Councillor Maynard has warned that much green belt will have to be sacrificed. There are currently 8 definite new developments and 4 possibles to be considered further by the local plan council officers. Of the possibles, 3 of the schemes are close to the Redbourne and the village faces almost doubling in size. The other site is in Park Street, on which developer Helioslough is planning a large rail freight terminal.
Ambulance delays led to severe harm for patients. 3 people were caused severe harm as a direct result of ambulance delays in our region over the winter, an independent investigation has concluded. The East of England Ambulance Service NHS Trust has been facing a number of challenges, including increased demand, particularly from an ageing population, and financial pressures. The service received in excess of 100,000 calls between December the 17th and January the 16th, during which time the Emergency Operations Centre was understaffed, and a whistleblower in a senior position in the Ambulance Trust claimed that at least 40 people were either harmed or died due to ambulance delays, including one person who froze to death. a risk summit was convened by NHS England and NHS Improvement at the end of January, and of the 47 cases identified to have potential issues, 22 were declared as serious incidents, and an independent investigation was launched. Carried out by senior independent clinicians from local NHS services, the investigation concluded this week that no patient died directly as a result of ambulance delays, but that three people were caused severe harm. Trust Chief Executive Robert Morton said, "I would like to apologise to every family involved. We welcome the review and we will learn from each and every case." Dr. Tom Davis, Medical Director for the NHS Trust, added, "We are clearly saddened that delays in ambulance responses meant patients waited much longer than they should have done. I am making sure each of the families affected is contacted to talk through their loved one's case. Even one case is one too many." The investigation confirmed a gap between capacity and demand. To meet national standards, an extra 330 frontline staff and 160 double-staffed ambulances need to be on the road by the end of the financial year 2019-2020. The 19 clinical commissioning groups in the East of England, which pay for the Ambulance Trust services, have agreed a six-year contract with the EEAST, which will see funding rise from the £213 million spent in 2017-18 to £225 million in 2018-19 and £240 million in 2019-20.
Heartsad comment, what we think. Thameslink remains tight-lipped. Just a few days before the introduction of Thameslink's new timetable, Govia's chief executive, Charles Horton, told the Hearts ad, "The impact on peak time services during the transition will be minimal. How wrong could he be?" In fact, the impact was nothing short of catastrophic and continues to cause huge disruption to services almost 2 weeks later, with no signs of things improving for the foreseeable future. Communication is consistently failing, with onboard messages conflicting with announcement boards, drivers not sure whether their trains are fast, slow, or cancelled altogether. Those services which do run are frequently overcrowded and late, making the journeys into London even more uncomfortable than usual, despite the introduction of new trains. Although it is the line's passengers which are obviously feeling the brunt of cancellations and delays, one also has to feel sorry for the Thameslink social media team, beleaguered drivers and station staff who are caught up in the whole sorry mess and find themselves having to deal with the impact of the crisis. They have been let down in a different way to rail users, but are suffering all the same. So, with Thameslink's senior management churning out the same stock answers in response to criticism from all sides, we wanted to give them the opportunity to explain in an in-depth interview exactly why the situation had occurred and what was happening behind the scenes to rectify the problems caused by the timetable change. They refused. Instead, we are sent a cursory apology with a promise that the disruption will ease over the coming month. That's probably the whole of June, then. In the meantime, commuters are merely expected to endure because that's what they always do. A captive market forced to pay for a service which isn't delivering on expectations because they have no other option if they want to get to work. Why should passengers be punished because revised working practices can't be implemented as advertised? This timetable was supposed to herald a new golden age of reliability, comfort, and capacity. But despite all the promises, we're still waiting for the promised sea change. The thing is, had Govia been open and honest from the start of the recent problems, then they could possibly have won over the hearts and minds of their customers. Instead, they attempt to spoon-feed passengers excuses from the same old jar, failing to recognise that tomorrow's expected jam now leaves a bitter taste in the mouth.
The St Albans branch of Amnesty International held a tree-planting ceremony in honour of a Pakistani lawyer who stood up against injustice. In 1976, Mukhtar Rana, a former prisoner of conscience in Pakistan, planted a golden ash tree in the Vintry Gardens near the cathedral. Mukhtar had been jailed and tortured for speaking up for human rights before Amnesty International secured his release. The St Albans Amnesty Group ceremony took place in recognition of the 70th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and planted an evergreen strawberry tree to replace the original justice ash. Mukhtar Rana has since died, but his daughter-in-law Mona and his grandchildren Sasha and Dil attended the ceremony alongside Mayor Mohammed Iqbal Zia, who said taking part in the event was a great honour.
A new beer promoting wildlife conservation has been introduced at the Old Fighting Cocks by the Hearts and Middlesex Wildlife Trust and Farbrew, the brewers. Named Wildlife by a competition winner, the beer is the result of a partnership between the St Albans-based Trust and the Wheatamstead Brewery. Farbrew's co-owner, Nick Farr, said, "We are thrilled to have launched our new pale ale in support of a trust. Caring for our local community and environment is core to Farbrew's values, so partnering with a trust in this way is the perfect fit. We look forward to hearing what everyone thinks of the new beer." The brewery are also working with the Trust on making the area where they grow the hops wildlife friendly. The Trust's conservation manager, Tim Hill, said, "Farbrew shares our passion for conserving local wildlife. This is an exciting partnership which will contribute to our work to achieve a living landscape across Hertfordshire."
Bunnings. The two Bunnings warehouses in St Albans will be rebranded as Homebase Stores after its parent company sold the business. Wes Farmers, which originally changed many of the Homebase stores into Bunnings warehouses, has sold the brand for £1. There are two Bunnings outlets in St Albans, on Griffiths Way and Hatfield Road, but it is not yet known what will happen to them or their staff. The Hearts Advertiser previously reported in February that Wes Farmers had made a loss of $1.3 billion on the DIY chain. A spokesperson said at the time it was too early to say if the stores would be closing.
Harpenden Carnival. Festivities will take place on Saturday, June the 9th, and will follow a Wild West theme. The town's new mayor, David Heritage, said Harpenden Town Council is extremely happy to once again be working in partnership with Harpenden Roundtable to bring you the town's social event of the year. It will kick off with a procession of people in Wild West dress along the High Street, led by the Rampage Mass Band and local schools. On Harpenden Common, there will be ferret races and the annual Savills Dog Show, with prizes awarded for waggiest tail and scruffiest mutt. In addition, bands will be playing Western Swing County and rock music on the Oracle Cancer Trust stage. Although the event is free, volunteers will be collecting donations for MIND, Hertfordshire Action on Disability, Roundtable and several other groups.
An awards ceremony has celebrated the achievements of former offenders who've turned their lives around. HACRO, or the Hertfordshire Association for the Care and Resettlement of Offenders, which is based in St Albans, held the ceremony at the University of Hertfordshire in Hatfield. More than 150 people attended the event, which honoured the achievements and commitments of ex-offenders, volunteers and partner organisations. The Turn Your Life Around Award went to a woman who first became involved with the criminal justice system at age 14 and amassed 28 convictions between 1999 and 2011. She's now looking to start a foundation degree in science and is in the process of obtaining independent accommodation. Local companies and personal sponsors present at the event included St Albans Priory and Harpenden Rotary Clubs, the High Sheriff of Hertfordshire and Hearts County Council Chairman Richard Thake.
I have news of a different awards or celebration. Awards celebrating those businesses which bring about economic, social or environmental benefits for the community have been launched by St Albans Chamber of Commerce. The annual Community Business Awards are open to any business or individual in the district and culminate in a presentation ceremony at the Noak Hotel on October the 4th. The nine categories for this year are Young Employee, New Business, Green Business, Best Restaurant, Best Leader, Corporate Social Responsibility, Business Growth, Community Champion, and the President's Award.
Petition. A petition to have the government's contract with Govia Thameslink Railway removed immediately has attracted over 2,500 signatures in 24 hours. The petition was started on the UK Parliament website on Monday and will run for 6 months until Thursday, November the 29th. It reads, "The Secretary of State should intervene immediately over GTR's failure to implement its new timetable, leaving commuters stranded and mass cancellations of services. Govia Thameslink has consistently had the worst performance figures of any train operating company in England. It has failed to improve services and now totally failed to deliver on its own new timetable, leading to total chaos. It is contributing to lost man hours, harming the economy and failing in all aspects of customer service."
Hall of Fame. An entrepreneur who owns an hotel in St Albans has been inducted into the British Travel and Hospitality Hall of Fame. Hotelier Vivek Chadha of Watford has been named Young Entrepreneur of the Year at the Hall of Fame Awards, which were held in London's Dorchester Hotel. Vivek is founder and director of the Nine Hotel Group, which includes the Mercure St Albans Noak Hotel in Watford Road, St Albans, and which recently invested in the 30 million Novotel Hotel at Heathrow Airport. The company employs more than 800 people, and Vivek currently has 18 hotels in his portfolio, alongside a mix of residential and commercial properties. He said, "I feel a true sense of pride in joining such an established roster of renowned names, and it's a personal career highlight for me to be awarded as Young Entrepreneur of the Year for Hospitality."
And now some gardening news. Charles Dowding will appear as a guest speaker of the Sandridge Road Allotment Association to talk about no-dig vegetable gardening, both at home and on allotments. He has appeared on The Beechgrove Garden on BBC Two and on Gardener's World with Monty Don, and is the author of several gardening books. He has travelled throughout the UK giving talks on no-dig methodology. Martin Astley from Sandridge Road Allotments Association said, "No-dig vegetable garden has really caught on because busy people can spend less time weeding and limit how much digging they need to do." The talk will take place at Bernard's Heath Junior School at 11:30 a.m. on Saturday, June the 9th, with doors opening at 11 a.m. Tickets cost £6, including refreshments.
A St Albans technology startup, which produces tourism acts for cities, has been recognised by the UK Innovation Agency. Smart World Connect, producers of the Smart City app, has been named Startup of the Year by Innovate UK. The app shows users information on car parks, charging stations for electric cars, and where there is traffic in cities in India, Spain and elsewhere. The company's CEO, Tony Bricknell, said, "We are delighted to have won the Innovate UK Startup of the Year award. I'd like to think it is because we're helping to solve real issues for cities around the world who are struggling to get long-term commitment for the smart city initiatives that lead to sustainability and using smart technology to engage the community. A prestigious award like this reinforces our belief that we're trying to do the right thing, and that our app can be a great way to help solve real city issues."
Cathedral accolade. St Albans Cathedral has been inducted into the Tourism Hall of Fame by TripAdvisor for consistently receiving good ratings from many of its 200,000 visitors per year. The attraction runs free guided tours every day and hosts events such as the Alban Pilgrimage, which commemorates St Alban, after whom the city is named. The Dean of St Albans Cathedral, the Very Reverend Dr Geoffrey John, said, We are all delighted to know that St Albans Cathedral has been included in the TripAdvisor Hall of Fame Award. Welcoming people is in the DNA of the place. Ever since Alban took in a fugitive priest 1,700 years ago and gave up his life for him. It is a real delight to have so many people coming to enjoy the atmosphere and beauty of the building and its setting, and to read on TripAdvisor how much it has meant to them. Thank you, and keep coming back.
And now sport with football. Two goals from both Mikhail Glowacki and Will Stone gave St Albans City Youth U9 West the trophy in the Mid-Hearts Rural Miners League Emerald Division Cup Final. Their goals meant a 4-1 win over Potters Bar Black. Glowacki opened the scoring inside 2 minutes after a superb pass from Ben Burt, and they doubled their lead 10 minutes later when he turned provider for Stone to tap the ball home. Barr pulled one back from the penalty spot before the break, but in the second period, the young Saints came out stronger. Glowacki got their third and his second, following a throw-in from Jack Burke. And after this goal, Potters Bar gradually lost confidence. And the young Saints put their game to bed when Stone scored his second with a great shot that smashed off the underside of the bar before finding the back of the net. It was a fitting end to a great cup run, which saw the side win 4-1 in the quarter-final and 7-2 in the semi-final.
This is Rupert Evershed reading my monthly Nature Notes article for the Hearts Advertiser. Make an appointment with the Dawn Chorus this spring. This last weekend, on Sunday, it was the International Dawn Chorus Day, an event instigated in the 1980s after Chris Baines, a then TV presenter, reputedly invited friends to celebrate his birthday at 4 a.m. so that they could listen to the Dawn Chorus of Birdsong. Of course, the Dawn Chorus has been going on for many millennia before that, but it was the official day established in 1987 that ever since has highlighted, celebrated and promoted one of nature's great wonders, and one which we, living in a temperate region of the world, get to enjoy every spring. Living in suburban St Albans, the Dawn Chorus in spring is almost guaranteed from your bedroom window, wherever you live. You may not think that there are many birds in your garden, but thankfully birdsong is not defined or contained by our fences and boundaries. Instead, quite the opposite is true, as birdsong declares and defines nature's boundaries through song. The Dawn Chorus is a bout of oral jousting between birds that the writer and naturalist Mark Cocker describes as their version of territorial warfare conducted through music. Rising to the top of the singing charts in spring is the blackbird, whose patient and quiet practicing of his song during the winter months from the dark depths of a bush finally pays off. His squeaky winter subsong endured the punching tones of his relative the song thrush, and now emerges as the sound of spring, a soft warbling meditation that is the soothing backdrop to every first barbecue. The song brings a depth to spring and a richness that wasn't there in the winter months, for each blackbird is answered by a rival bird, maybe a few gardens away, and that in turn is gently rebuffed by another, even more distant bird. A luxuriant layer of sound is added to our landscape and enriches the balm of a warm spring day. The name Dawn Chorus is a bit of a misnomer. in that if you rise as the sun appears, the chances are you will have missed the main performance that actually begins a good hour before sunrise. It may be that you are well aware of this, having woken recently, like me, well before the alarm clock is due to go off, by the repetitive squeaky wheelbarrow song of the great tit, or the angry cries of crows seeing off a skulking fox before first light. This is no way to enjoy the dawn chorus, and if there is one thing I would encourage every person to do this spring, it is this, to make an appointment with the dawn chorus and get out in it. This, of course, means setting the alarm clock for 4 a.m, maybe even earlier, and getting outside, ideally in as rich a natural habitat as possible. Sticking your head out of the bedroom window will give you a taste of what's on offer, but to be out in nature as the dawn chorus swells, rises and unfolds all around you is intoxicating. Birdsong is beautiful, but when combined in unison with the first light of dawn, the sweet smell of may blossom and the cool dew on shining gossamer threads, you are left looking for your next fix. Every year I make a pilgrimage to Kent in May for a mad day of birdwatching, the rough aim being to see as many different birds in a 24-hour period as possible. It is a hangover from university days when a group of us raced around Kent as part of a yearly county-wide sponsored competition. However, it is not the day count as such that draws me back, and the competitive flavour to the day has long since gone. It is the chance to be out in nature at dawn and experience one of the best dawn choruses that the UK has to offer. In an undeniably crazy rejection of the messages our body naturally gives us, we start in a marshland setting at midnight, where the birds never really go quiet. Bitterns boom, cuckoos call, and marsh frogs holler. At times it is deafening. We then move on to a parkland setting at 4 a.m, where the tentative song of redstarts ring out in the pre-dawn darkness, interspersed by the amphibian calls of roding woodcock and squeaking baby owls. And then it breaks, slowly at first, but quickly overwhelming. The full voice of the parkland birdsong rises with the sun, banishing the lingering mist patches and warming every leaf in a carpet of song. It is exhilarating, uplifting, deafening, and any thoughts that it would have been better to stay in bed vanish as nature's drug takes full effect. My appointment with dawn is this Friday. When will yours be?
Right, this is Peter Burley bringing you a preview of some of the events in the district from mid-June to mid-July. And it being summer, we do indeed have some outdoor events, so I'm hoping everybody's keeping their fingers crossed for actually having a summer this year. I really felt we missed out on one last year. We've already had some very nice weather. I'm hoping we haven't used it all up before the summer's really started. Anyway, we'll start with some weatherproof events at the Cathedral. And we have a lunchtime organ recital, and that's on Wednesday the 11th of July at 12:30 p.m. in the afternoon. And that's given by Alberto Brigandi and Alessandro Urbani, who are from Highgate and Luxembourg, respectively. And they'll be giving a performance of works, including movements of Holst's The Planets. Admission is free and there's a retiring collection. A much bigger event, if the organist will forgive me, is on Saturday the 14th of July. That's Bastille Day, of course. And it's Mendelssohn's Elijah, performed by the St Albans Bach Choir, with the St Albans Cathedral Choir, the St Albans Abbey Girls Choir, and the Abbey Singers. And this will be at 7:30 p.m. I'm afraid I haven't got the ticket price, but I suspect it will be reasonably expensive, because it's a big prestige performance. And we've got some other things on at the Cathedral over our period. And a reminder that the St Albans Pilgrimage takes place on Saturday the 23rd of June this year. The procession starts at St Peter's Church at 11 a.m. and then things run over through the middle of the day. Now, bear that in mind because it will interact with some other events I'm going to mention later. There are also two, I think, unusually interesting talks coming up at the Cathedral. And the first is called Exploring the Earliest Story of St Alban, A Window on Late Roman Britain. And that's going to be on Thursday the 19th of June at 7:30 p.m. and it's going to be, I think, in the Lady Chapel. But if you book a ticket, which I'm afraid will cost you £10, you will then find out. It will be given by Mark Lanesmith, who's from the University of Reading. Now, the second talk is actually very topical indeed, and it's being given by Professor James Clark from the University of Exeter, and it's on John Wheatamstead, and he's entitled his talk, The Renaissance Abbot. Now, James Clark will be talking about Wheatamstead and the rediscovery of his remains last year on Thursday, the 28th of June. This time it'll be at 8 p.m, price £10, and that is in the Lady Chapel. Now, some of you may recall the name James Clark. He's been here a couple of times over the last couple of years, talking about medieval St Albans and the Abbey as it then was. So he's a very welcome returning visitor. Now, changing tempo and mood entirely, we have the St Albans Folk Festival in our period. That runs from the 15th to the 17th of June. And on the 15th, we have an open evening at the Friday Folk Dance Club. That's in the Maltings. On Saturday, June the 16th, there's Morris dancing and performances in a whole range of pubs, workshops in the Maltings Theatre. Then we have the festival concert at the Maltings Theatre at 8 p.m. And that'll feature the Dovetail Trio and Granny's Attic. And then on Sunday, the 17th, there's going to be sessions and sing-arounds in local pubs. Unfortunately, the flyer doesn't say how much the concert costs, although I think, suspect if you turn up at the door, you will be able to get in. Now, another complete change of tack. We're going across to the Sandpit Theatre at Sandringham School, because on Saturday, the 16th of June, they're performing the musical Annie. And that's going to be two performances, 2:30 p.m. and then 6:30 p.m. again. I don't think the musical needs much introduction from me. It's being performed by the Spotlight Company, and tickets for that are £14 or £10. And then we've got an arts festival at the Sandpit Theatre, or at Sandringham School generally, which runs from the 2nd to the 5th of July, and there are events at 7 p.m. every evening, including concerts, competitions and dance showcases. And finally, we have Robin and the Sherwood Hoodies, and that is a toe-tickling tale of tights, fights and footlights, and that's going to be performed on Thursday the 12th and Friday the 13th of July, performances on both nights at 6:30 p.m, and it's free. Now, I think I may have mentioned last time that Hertfordshire Jazz has relocated to St Albans, and I'm still struggling to catch up with the full implications of that, and I've not got the July programme, but they have published the programme that deals with the end of June. So on the 19th of June, there's going to be Pete Long's Sextet, doing a performance called Celestial Bodies, and that's going to be, say, a jazz concert in the Maltings. Then on the 26th of June, we have a James Pearson Trio, and again at the Maltings. Now, the concerts are all on Tuesdays, and they're all at 7:30 p.m. If you sign up to be a member of the Hearts Jazz Club, you obviously get discounts. Now it's in St Albans, that might be more worth thinking about doing. If you're not a member, you can buy advance tickets for £13 or £12. If you're turning up on the night on spec, it's £15 or £14. Now, St Peter's Church has got lunchtime concerts on the 20th of June by Curtis Elton on the piano, 27th of June by a performer known as To Be Confirmed, the 4th of July, Fleetwood School, and on the 11th of July, Mitra Alice Tam on the piano. In Harpenden, we have one morning coffee concert on the 23rd of June. It's at 10:30 a.m. and it's Roger Carter on the organ performing a piece called Mighty Oaks from Little Acorns Grow. And it's part of a larger arts festival called Cultivate. I tried to find out more about this larger arts festival, but I'm afraid I have failed. But it's anyway, it's part of a larger scheme of music and performances. Now, staying with folk music, or going back to folk music, I should say, Friday the 1st of June, we have a folk concert at the Maltings. It's at 8 p.m. and it's Celtic fiddle and cello duo Arn Dar plus Elizabeth and Jameson. And tickets for that will be £12 or £11. On Saturday the 30th of June, it's going to be a busy evening, I warn you. Saturday the 30th of June, the St Albans Chamber Choir are putting on a concert at St Saviour's Church, backed up with the Amadeus Chamber Orchestra, and they'll be performing works by Malcolm Arnold, Vaughan Williams, William Alwyn and Cecilia McDowell. Now, tickets for that concert are all £15. Oh, I should have added, it's actually themed Music for Midsummer. Then the St Albans Choral Society will be performing in the Jubilee Hall in St Albans High School for Girls, and that's on Townsend Avenue, also on Saturday the 30th, and also at 7:30 p.m. And their concert is entitled A Time for All Seasons, supported by the Beaumont School Vocal Ensemble. They'll be performing works also by Celia McDowell, but by James McMillan, Bob Chilcott and John Rutter. Tickets for that are £16 or concessionary tickets £14. Now, the 30th of June keeps on giving because we have the Marlborough School Epic Summer Music Festival. And that's going to run right through the day. And it will cost you £15 for adults. And it's obviously at Marlborough School. And there's a whole range of, mostly looks like tribute events going on right through the day. Moving on to Saturday the 7th of July, we have a concert by Carillon called The Roaring Forties, and that's being performed in the Foden Hall at Rothamsted Research Station in Harpenden. And it's Celebrate With Us as we enter our fourth decade with an end-of-season concert featuring traditional sea songs and classics from the 1940s swing era. And that will cost you £13. Now, the St Albans Bar Choir have a concert on Saturday the 14th of July, which I realise, as I read this out, I have previewed because it's in the cathedral. Right, but something I haven't previewed, the St Albans Organ Theatre, we have a concert also on Saturday the 14th of July at 7:30 p.m. It's given by David Ivory, who is a popular East Anglian organist. And this concert will include a musical tour of the Animal Kingdom. Now, let's go to the arena. And very surprisingly, although it's a busy year there, there's actually very few events in our period. And the first one runs from Wednesday the 27th through to Saturday the 30th of June, and it's the West End hit musical, The Wind in the Willows. And the script is by Julian Fellows, and the music is by George Stiles. Now, the performances are at 7:30 p.m. on every one of those evenings, with a matinee on Wednesday at 1:30 p.m. and on Saturday at 2:30 p.m. Tickets are all £19.50 or £15. Then, on Monday the 2nd of July, we have an evening with Dan Snow. Now, he's the historian and broadcaster. Tickets to hear him will be £25 or £20, and you can buy family tickets as well. Now, he's just going to be talking about his career as a historian and TV presenter. I can recommend it. I have heard him speak before, and he is very good. He's not just a sort of facade with nothing behind it. When we heard him speak, he knew a lot more about his subject when he was able to get into his lecture, which is always really, really good. Then, last event we've got is Rare Productions presenting the musical Bugsy Malone. And this is being performed on Thursday the 5th of July through to Saturday the 7th of July. The tickets are £16.50, working their way down to £13, depending on which day and which performance you get. I'm sorry, they have not printed the times, which is really rather surprising. Anyway, that's it for the arena. Let's move north to Harpenden and have a look at what's going on there. And on Friday the 15th of June at 7:30 p.m, all tickets seated, all tickets £18, we have a group called the Bohemians, who are a Queen tribute band, and they'll be performing all of Queen's famous hits. Sunday the 24th of July, 7:30 p.m, all tickets £18, all tickets seated, we have the group called the Kilkennys, and they've gained a reputation for revitalising traditional Irish music. Then we have the Rhythm Kings, and they'll be performing on Wednesday the 27th of June, 7:30 p.m, all tickets £26.50 and all tickets seated. And one of the people they're featuring is the son of Otis Redding, who is also called Otis Redding. Then we have Ron Vincent singing Cat Stevens songs, and he actually looks like Cat Stevens and has a cat beside him, like one of his album covers. That's on Friday the 29th of June at 7:30 p.m. This is getting boring. All tickets £18, all tickets seated. And the last one we have is the Upbeat Beatles, which is another Beatles tribute band, and they'll be performing on Saturday the 30th of June at 7:30 p.m. And this time they're £20. We've broken the mould on pricing, and all tickets are seated. Now, a bit of drama. We've actually got no plays at the Abbey Theatre in our period, but we do have the first of two outdoor theatre performances at Shaw's Corner, and that's on Friday the 22nd, Saturday the 23rd and Sunday the 24th of June, 6:30 p.m. on all three nights, and they're performing a play called Widower's Houses. Obviously, it's by George Bernard Shaw. The play starts at 6:30 p.m. and the gates open at 5 p.m. for picnics. Tickets are £25 in advance or £30 on the night, and there is a discount if you are a National Trust member. And the box office number is 0344 249 1895. Now, not drama, but comedy. We have the mostly comedy season. We have on the 5th of July a bill including stand-up from the three times Perrier-nominated Reginald D. Hunter, a national name, and Red Dwarf's Hattie Hayridge. And they'll be performing at the Maltings at 8 p.m, and tickets for them will be £13. Now, I promise you some outdoor events, and the first one is a sort of all-embracing one. It's the Auburn Weekend from the 23rd to 24th of June. We're celebrating the remarkable heritage of the city, so there'll be loads of things open. And, of course, it includes the Pilgrimage, which I previewed, and the St Auburn Street Festival, which I haven't yet. That's on Sunday, the 24th of June. It's from noon to 6 p.m. And the whole city centre is taken over to performances, street food and fun, sporting activities. It says World War One activities. I'm going to dig a trench somewhere, I expect. And there's face painting. It's obviously free because it's just the whole of the city centre opened up with stalls. Now, Rossumsted Research Centre have their open day, or open days, plural, I should say, on the same day, that same weekend, 23rd and 24th of June. And they're open from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. And it's subtitled this year, A Festival of Ideas, because they're showcasing their 175 years of agricultural research work. Just seems like yesterday they started up, doesn't it? Then we have a festival called, where are we? It's at John Laws, and it's the Festival on the Field, it's called. It's a John Law School. It's on their playing fields in Harpenden. And it's an all-day festival featuring particularly Cuban rhythms. And it will be, let's say, an all-day festival. And I'm just looking for when it starts. Last year, 2,500 people went there, by the way. Oh, it's an ELO tribute band, a Coldplay tribute act. Doesn't say when the doors open. My guess is about noon. Now, we have the St Auburn's Town and Country Show, which is on Saturday the 7th of July. And that does, I've got the timings here, it starts at 11 in the morning and runs through to 6 in the evening. And it's on Saturday the 7th and Sunday the 8th. And it's set in the grounds of Highfield Country Park. And it's got things if you're a food lover or a dog lover, want a family day out, there's living history. There's lots of demonstrations, dog demonstrations and cookery demonstrations. There'll be celebrity chefs. And there's a whole load of things going on. I'm not sure if there's an entry fee or not. It doesn't say this on the information I've got. Now, we have got the Tillicbury Arts Fair on the 6th, 7th and 8th of July. They've got over 60 artists exhibiting. And if you think, well, that's all pictures, you're wrong. It's a very, very good day out because as well as all obviously the local artists displaying, there's live music and bands performing through the day and lots of street food and other stalls and things to do there. Tickets will be £8 or £7. Doors open at 10 a.m. and it finishes at 5 p.m. As I say, refreshments and live food, and it's a fabulous day out. And now lastly, still on the open air theme, we have got, on the 30th of June, Harpenden Armed Forces Day, which means that there is quite a lot of activity going on the street. And then on the 8th of July, we have one of the annual highlights of a district. We have the Harpenden Highland Gathering, which will be in Rossumsted Park. So, dust off your cabers and get ready to fling them.
Hello, I'm Bill, and my guest in the studio today is Town Mayor of Harpenden, Councillor Rosemary Farmer. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Good morning, Bill. Delighted to be here. And please feel free to call me Rosemary.
Shall we start with just a few words about how you come to be the mayor?
Yes. The first thing that we always think it's obvious, but it's not always to everybody else. You do have to be a councillor or a town councillor. And then it's a position you hold for a year. And basically you are chosen by your fellow councillors, your group that you're nominated earlier in the year. And then at what we call the annual meeting, which is next week, you're proposed and seconded and voted in as mayor. So it is a legal requirement that you do have to be voted in as mayor and sign a declaration.
Right, I see. So just to put this into the time context, as this won't be going out today, it can be going out in June or July, May the 15th is the date of the annual meeting of council and the mayor-making ceremony.
Yes, that's right.
So by the time people hear this, it will be a few weeks in the
past.
Yes,
I will effectively have retired from the position. And as some people know, obviously it's the third time I've been mayor in any case. Yes, so I shall have stepped down by then.
And you don't wish to continue then? No, you're not. Do you put yourself forward for this position then in the council?
No, you're nominated by your fellow councillors and ask if you do. Frequently it's not. It's actually you have a deputy mayor and normally you'd expect the deputy mayor will follow on and be nominated.
I see. Okay.
Or at least a town. That's how it works at the town council at Harpenden. Mm. Yes.
So have you enjoyed this period of time?
Yes, hugely. Yes. Well, for a start, because it's a huge honour to serve your community. And it's also hugely enjoyable. I mean, there are lots of things about it that are great. Personally, I think the greatest thing about it is all the people you meet and finding out all the people who do so much in the community. And of all ages, and visiting schools and talking to people. I like talking to people, and it's, to me, that's one of the great things about it. And it's the fact that you are able to honour the people who do things for the town, who often are the unsung heroes.
Yes, and you're very involved in charitable organisations locally.
Yes.
Could you tell me a little bit about that?
I'm on the Care Fund Committee at the Harpenden Trust, which is a very long established charity serving the residents of the town. I've been involved for quite a few years now with an organisation called DrugLink that is a substance misuse charity. It's actually based in Hemel Hempstead. It does a certain amount of work locally and some work it does nationally. And I was chairman of that for 5 years, I think. But I stepped down at the last AGM as chairman, but I remain a trustee of it. So I'm involved in that. I'm very interested in mental health, and it's not exactly charitable work, but I'm through the district council, I'm an appointed member of the Partnership Foundation University Trust, which is the mental health trust for the county, so I'm very involved in that as well. So I take a very keen interest in all aspects of mental health.
Right. And as mayor, what kind of contribution does that allow you to make?
Well, there are two ways it allows you to make contributions. One, of course, is attending many different events which will help raise money for a wide variety of charities and visiting the charities themselves and supporting them. And the other area, of course, is that mayor will always traditionally have charities that you do fundraising events for throughout the year.
I see.
My two charities for this time were Rennie Grove Hospice and, well, what's known as the Harpenden Hopper, which is Harpenden Community Connect, which is a Harpenden Connect, which is an entity we've fairly recently set up to provide community transport in the town.
Right.
Particularly starting out in areas where there's limited or no public transport, but using it widely, but that's my other charity.
So that's a Harpenden initiative.
It's a Harpenden initiative, very much so, yes.
Well, that sounds very worthwhile, because public transport around Harpenden is fairly restricted, fairly limited.
Yes, there are some otherwise good services, but there are areas of the town, like many towns, where, yes, you're not going to get it, and it's where there aren't public transport routes. But it's more than just dealing with that. I think it's about trying to, over a period of time, persuade people to not always take their cars out, to use it widely, to get it widely used, to help towards sustainable transport.
Yes, I think that's that sounds very good to me, because I live in one of the surrounding villages myself,
yes,
and we have lanes that are always clogged up with very large 4x4s and other vehicles.
Yes. Hertfordshire has surprisingly small lanes. I thought, having spent many years backwards and forwards with Dorset, I didn't think anywhere could have a smaller lanes, and I've discovered Carpen. Well, Hertfordshire does. Yes.
It certainly does, yes.
Yeah.
So in terms of other kinds of issues that face a town like Harpenden currently. Are you involved in things like roads and parking arrangements? Or?
Yes, and as far as we put input into it, but roads, and it's something that always confuses people, is that you do have clear lines of which level of local government deals with what. We're what is called a sort of three-tier authority in Hertfordshire. So we have a county council, a district council, and a town council. And for instance, roads are the bailiwick of the district, the county council. Mm-hmm. But obviously we can feed in input and suggestions or let them know if there are things we're worried about. And parking is the bailiwick of the district council. But that's not to say we don't get involved, and we will work with fellow councillors and groups to look at issues and hopefully gradually work towards where we can towards solutions.
So I do notice in Harpenden that parking can be a bit of a problem.
Yes, I think it is probably. Yes, it can be. I don't think it's any different from anywhere else. It's simply car ownership in this country is hugely expanded. And whereas once upon a time, you might have people would have. Well, I'm old enough to remember when many people didn't have a car at all back in the 50s and 60s. Expanded to many people having one, then you went to two, and now you have with families and teenagers as well who get their own cars, you can have five cars. So, but it is something, yes, we're looking, and I think all groups, are all different tiers are working together to try and find solutions, but this is a personal view, there's always going to be a bit of issue because you're going to have so many people have so many cars.
Yes, when they were, and the roads just were built and designed a long time ago.
Long before even basic, for most places, the road layouts and the way they work. I mean, they predate a car, never mind anything, never mind the numbers of cars.
Yes,
many of
indeed,
them do.
Indeed, yes. Yeah. Now, I noticed that you have an engagement this afternoon.
I do.
And tell me a little bit about that.
Oh, I'm visiting one of our local primary schools, which is always a joy because the young children take such an interest. And that's actually to visit one of the gardening clubs. I think the schools, most if not all of them now, have a gardening club, which is an excellent thing for them all to get. Well, it gets youngsters outside. It gets them interested in gardening. And I'm sure from what I've read, there are, won't be all, but many will retain an interest in that all their lives. And I'm going up, I know they do, as other schools do, they're going up, I think they're probably about, I've got a sort of planting time of year, they have very nice vegetable gardens up there. And I know later in the year, then they go and all harvest their vegetables and cook them. They're really very good. I went in the late summer, I went along, it's actually because I happened to chair Harpenden in Bloom. I was going along with somebody else measuring sunflowers to find the tallest sunflower, and I thought their garden looked fantastic. But it's always a joy to visit our schools, any of them. I've been to quite a few schools visits this year. Mm-hmm. And I also think it's important with young people that they see, if you like, democracy in action.
Yes.
To get them.
Very good lesson.
Hopefully interested. Yes, I think interested to just see, yes, at least the sort of face of the democratic representation.
And you'll be wearing your regalia.
Yes, I will take the chain with me. Yes. Oh, yes, they'd be very disappointed if I didn't. I do find young children, it's very sweet, actually. The young children, particularly in the primary schools, the younger ones, they absolutely love the chain. They're fascinated by it.
Now, tell me something about this, because there are certain individual elements.
Yes, you've got the chain, which is, it's mounted on velvet, I'm pleased to say, otherwise it would be a bit heavy and would also slip off my not very big shoulders. Then you have, round the back, you have of it, there are, I think it's two rows now, we'll probably have to start a third in not too long, with little medallions on, which have the names of the past mayors. In fact, it predates when we had mayors and has chairman on it as well, because before Harpenden became a town council and before the big local government reorganisation in the early 70s, it was an urban district council, so we had chairman. And it was donated to the town in 1953 by a retiring solicitor. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that people, if they notice, always look at, we've got two, if you like, enamelled medallions. The first is the armorial bearings of the town, as you'd expect. But there's another smaller one above it, which if people look closely at, will see it's Mount Everest.
How very interesting.
And then they say, oh, Mount Everest. Why is that? And of course, it was given to us in 1953. And there were two residents of the town, Dr. Pugh and Mike Westmacott, who were important members of the 1953 Everest expedition, which, of course, for I'm sure all your listeners will know, was the first time it was climbed and was announced on coronation morning. But the youngsters don't know that, so I tell them the story. And so Mike Westmacott was then worked for Rothamsted, and Dr. Pugh was a GP, and both were doing research. So it's to recognise the little role Harpenden had to play in that.
Yes.
Really very well, for those of us of a certain age, at least, very
well, I don't actually remember it.
Remember it. I'm not quite that old enough either, but I think I'm well aware of it. No, I'm not either. I wasn't very old at the time.
Well, I think it's a very interesting piece of history, that, too, because, of course, it coincided with the coronation.
Yes, exactly.
Queen Elizabeth's coronation.
Yes.
And there was a sort of sense of national pride that we,
yes.
the British
yes.
expedition, had managed yes. to climb Everest for the first time.
Yes.
At the same yes. same year.
And announced it on coronation morning.
So you do believe that in this modern age that the role of town mayor is a valuable one.
Yes, I do. And I know that it is appreciated by many people in the town. It is that basically a mayor, and I'm not talking about, you know, elected mayors now, I'm talking about mayors such as I am. You have, if you like, two roles. One is to chair the full council meeting and manage that, and a mayor technically has complete control over a council meeting, is the only one mm-hmm. who, not that I can see it ever happening, but it's the only one who's got the powers to suspend or stop a meeting if you had problems. But mm-hmm. the other very important part of it is the civic role. And if you are, if you like, inverted commas, the first citizen of the town, and that role is very much to honour and to recognise the citizens of that town and to serve them. And it is, and I know from people who come up to me in the street who say, oh, it was very nice to see you at something, or who appreciate to go to concerts, or whatever it is you go to. It is appreciated, and it is important, because it is the way that somebody can represent the town and say, this event or this individual, this is really making a contribution to our town, this is important, and we are here to recognise that.
So it lends itself to a kind of community coherence,
yes.
and a sense of belonging.
Yes, it does, because if you like, you're a sort of focal point for that,
yes.
which I think is very important. And it's an interesting thing about Harpenden that although it's grown hugely over the last 50 years or so, it's managed to keep that sort of village community sense. And most of the older residents, and there are residents who've lived there, I know, who've lived there some all their lives, and it is usually still by many referred to as the village.
Is it?
Yes.
Ah, that's
yes.
very interesting. I hadn't heard that.
Oh, yes. Many will call it the village.
So you say it's grown a great deal.
Yes.
And there is pressure, for instance, for school places and so on.
Yes.
Because the schools in Harpenden are considered to be extremely good. And in fact, my children went there and they've done very well, so
yes,
we're very
good.
Pleased with
good.
Their schools. The person who is likely to take over from you
yes.
in May, do you know who that is? And would
oh,
you
yes,
be able
I mean,
to tell
public,
us or not?
Yes, I think I can, because it is fairly pretty well public knowledge. Well, in fact, because it's been through council once already earlier in the year. In fact, we do it that way early February council meeting, we actually nominate and put in the public domain. So, in fact, it will be my deputy councillor, David Heritage.
And you feel confident that the role of mayor in the future is going to continue to be valuable for the community?
Yes, I think it is. I think it's a very, not just for our community, but I think across communities, I think it's a very valuable role. And one of the things about it, of course, is, which I perhaps forgot to mention, and is a very important point, when you are acting as mayor and you're the representative of the town, you are non-political. You're the mayor, you're representing the town, you're representing the council. But as mayor, you are, when you're at an event or anything like that, you are not political.
So you're not representing a party?
You're elected from a party, but in the role as mayor, you're not. No, you're the mayor. You're representing the council and you are representing the community. But the mayor, if you like, stands as a neutral. You are not. And it would be most improper to go to, I don't know, say if I went, I don't know, any event I went to, you wouldn't take a political stance. You've got to keep it distinct because also in Harpenden, because we're a town council and size, you are, if you like, group leader and we're a group. And in that sense, yes. But when you are in the community as mayor, you are non-political.
Well, I think that fairly much wraps it up, unless there's anything else you'd like to say to our listeners.
No, except I hope they take some interest in it. And certainly within Harpenden and all our residents there, to thank people for their support for me during the year.
Well, thank you very much for coming this morning, and it's been very interesting talking to you. Thank you, Rosemary Farmer, Town Mayor of Harpenden and Councillor.
Thank you.
We now have this month's Thought for the Day. We'd like to thank the Hertfordshire Chorus for allowing us to use the music from one of their CDs. Don't forget Peter White's In Touch programme follows the Thought for the Day. We do hope that you've enjoyed listening to this recording of your talking newspaper. But for now, it's time to say goodbye from all of today's team. Goodbye and take care.
Hello and welcome to Journey, the audio thought for the week from Torch Trust. Today's thought is brought to us by Jill, who works in the audio transcription department at Torch.
Recently, I have been thinking about the seasons we go through in our lives. Rainy seasons, bright seasons. We all have times when things are going really well and times when things are really hard. So how do we cope in the hard times? We have all either seen or heard about a rainbow, that most beautiful phenomenon of nature. But even more beautiful is the meaning behind it, as given us in Genesis chapter 9. It was set by God himself in the clouds as a sign that he would always keep his promise that the earth would never again be totally flooded. Well, that is one particular promise, but of course it applies to every single promise God has ever made. And the Bible is absolutely full of them. Promises like, I will rescue you, I will sustain you, I will carry you. When you pass through the waters, I will be with you. God will meet all your needs. Your ears will hear a voice behind you saying, this is the way, walk in it. And he who promised is faithful. All these promises are like the many bands of colour within a rainbow. Bright, beautiful, awesome, even breathtaking, glowing with hope. One day I was driving back home from Torch House in Market Harborough on a day when we were having a mix of rain and sun. As I drove, a rainbow appeared straight ahead of me. It was so amazingly wonderful, I just had to stop the car to savour its beauty, the brightness of its many colours glowing so beautifully against the dark clouds behind it. As I watched, almost breathlessly, it became even more beautiful and bright. Why? The clouds behind it were becoming darker and darker, forming an ever-improving backdrop for the rainbow itself. The darker the clouds, the brighter and more beautiful the rainbow. I started reflecting on God's equivalent in our lives, the rainbow of his promises shining in the dark times. Isn't it true to say that the darker those times become, the brighter, in contrast, do those promises shine? This is wonderful. And unlike the rainbow that is seldom seen and fades, God's promises are always there and never fade. So how do we cope in times of trouble, hardship, uncertainty, fear, anxiety, illness? By looking at the rainbow, not the clouds, and by resting and trusting in those great and wonderful promises. So, by God's grace and the help of the Holy Spirit, let's determine to fix our gaze on the best rainbow of all, the rainbow of God's promises found all through Scripture, and relish every aspect of its beauty.
Thank you for listening to Journey from Torch Trust, the Christian charity for people who are blind or partially sighted. As well as running specialist holidays and a network of friendship groups, Torch has a free lending library of audiobooks for people who are blind or partially sighted. To find out more, you can go to our website at torchtrust.org or telephone 0333 123 1255.